When nuclear boosters set standards on what a so-called acceptable or harmless exposure to radioactivity is, what they don't tell you is that they're basing their evaluation on an adult male model. So when you hear a biologist, researcher, and genuine expert on nuclear issues tell you,
when men and women get the same exposure over time, women will get 50% more cancers than the men. But little girls got 10 times more.
Well, when you hear the truth of what nuclear radiation does to the genetic future of our species, you begin to understand the exact dangers of that seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we review how the real risks of radiation exposure have been hidden. We revisit a talk with Mary Olson. She is founder of the Gender and Radiation Impact Project, and she busts the nuclear establishment on the concept and usage of reference man as the model for understanding relative dangers of any radiation exposure. Spoiler alert, it's women and especially little girls who are far more at risk. And in memoriam, you will hear a powerful interview from 2016 with Mary Osco, a brave activist who fought for the cleanup of World War II radioactive nuclear weapons waste contamination in North St. Louis and Coldwater Creek, despite the fact that she had stage 4 lung cancer, which she attributed to her exposure. We'll also have nuclear news from around the world, Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, and more honest nuclear information than made it onto the Oscars. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, March 14, 2023, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting in the U.S. in California, where following unprecedented approval from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Pacific Gas and Electric Company has received an exemption to request to continue operations at its Diablo Canyon power plant beyond its current license, while its license renewal application is still under review. And the NRC sidestepped a legal argument from anti-nuclear activists who said the agency might be illegally extending the plant's operating license. While the extension is supposed to be good for only 5 years, it is believed that the NRC and the state will make an excuse and extend it for a full 20 years. This for two nuclear reactors built atop earthquake faults in a tsunami zone. As of Friday, March 2nd, the Biden administration is offering $1.2 billion in aid to extend the life of what they call distressed nuclear power plants, and could for the first time offer funding to a plant that has recently closed. The funding comes from the $6 billion Civil Nuclear Credit Program created by the 2021 Infrastructure Law. Last year, the Department of Energy provided $1.1 billion in conditional CNC funds to Diablo Canyon. In South Carolina, a former utility executive who gave rosy projections on the progress of two nuclear power plants in South Carolina when he knew they were hopelessly behind will spend 15 months in prison for the doomed project that cost ratepayers billions of dollars. The two V.C. Summer nuclear plants never generated a watt of power, despite costing $9 billion in investments. And ex-Scana Corporation Executive Vice President Stephen Byrne, now on his way to prison, apologized in court on Wednesday, saying he thinks about how he let down customers, shareholders, employees, taxpayers, and his family almost every day. You think? In Vermont, A train on its way to load up nuclear waste from the decommissioning Vermont Yankee nuclear power station derailed on February 24, 2023, said, "The whole idea of shipping high-level radioactive waste and spent nuclear fuel all over the country on rail lines is at the heart of what the Department of Energy wants to start in the years ahead. We should all be nervous about such a development in light of Palestine, Ohio, and many other such incidents. Fortunately, no radioactive waste was involved this time, leading North Star Group Services, the company that's been demolishing Vermont Yankee since 2019, to call it a minor derailment." That's like being a little bit pregnant or slightly dead. According to research from Stanford University and the University of British Columbia, small modular nuclear reactors, long touted as the future of nuclear energy, will actually generate more radioactive waste than conventional nuclear power plants. The study showed that most modular reactor designs will actually increase the volume of nuclear waste in need of management and disposal by factors of anywhere from 2 to 30. And the radioactive waste must be isolated from the environment for hundreds of thousands of years, something we don't yet know how to do. Now here's Linda Pence Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
Those of us foolish enough to spend time on Facebook likely all have friends who we are not sure we really know. We probably got a friend request from someone who seemed to know our personal friends, but does anyone actually know them? One such so-called friend popped up on my page last week after I defended a statement made by former England soccer great and now BBC soccer commentator Gary Lineker. In a short tweet, Lineker condemned the UK government's use of what he called, quote, "language not dissimilar to that used by Germany in the 30s, unquote, when the ruling Conservative Party rolled out its heartless new "We Must Stop the Boats" policy aimed at turning away desperate asylum seekers attempting to land on UK shores. Amidst a general rant about what she called these people, my Facebook acquaintance asserted that Lineker should, quote, "keep his ignorant mouth shut," unquote, since as a mere football commentator, the British term for soccer, he had no business voicing his opinion on immigration. This caught my attention for a number of reasons, the most obvious being that Lineker is probably one of the more intelligent television personalities of our time. But more importantly, this ludicrous but pervasive view about who is qualified to talk about what is one we have confronted in our movement as well. In particular, we hear that if we don't have a nuclear engineering degree, we have no scientific knowledge on which to base our opposition to nuclear power. Apart from the fact that this ignores the quite considerable number of qualified scientists in the field who are indeed highly critical of the nuclear power choice, it suggests that our academic qualifications entirely limit our capacity for thought, analysis, and deduction. I am reminded of the famous Marcel Pagnol quote, "My advice is to look out for engineers. They begin with sewing machines and end up with nuclear bombs." Imagine if the only people qualified to talk about nuclear bombs were the people who made them. What kind of a world would we have? This is effectively what those who say athletes should stick to talking only about sport are advocating. I have a degree in English and Italian literature from a very, very long time ago. But on Facebook and Twitter, I've been characterized as an English teacher, so what can she possibly know about nuclear power, they ask mockingly. Apart from the fact that I was never an English teacher, but since when has the pro-nuclear crowd been attentive to facts, this criticism suggests that after the age of about 21, the human brain loses the capacity to learn anything else. Whatever your degree or your skill, whether it's English literature or English football, that is the only topic about which you are allowed to think and on which you can pronounce for the rest of your life. Gary Lineker, like many high-profile people, discusses all sorts of topics of interest on his personal Twitter account. So does former tennis player Martina Navratilova and Star Trek actor George Takei, who endured the Japanese internment camps right here in the freedom-loving USA. They do it boldly and unapologetically, because why should they apologize? They are intelligent, thinking, and yes, caring human beings, and they have a platform and a huge audience. If they don't sound the warning about Nazi-style rhetoric and policies, where does that leave the rest of us? So yes, I supported Lineker. We can't let the voices who speak up for humanity and humanitarianism be silenced. Although that is exactly what the disgraceful BBC has now done by suspending Lineker from his Match of the Day job. And we will keep speaking out against the extreme dangers of nuclear power, because as human beings who can read, think, and analyze for ourselves, who can separate fact from fiction and empirical evidence from the all-pervasive pro-nuclear propaganda, we have a duty and a responsibility to do so. Otherwise, the next nuclear tragedy will be on us. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat, and that's this week's Hot Story.
Over to Japan, where on March 3rd, it was announced that the government would delay its plan to pump over 1.37 million tons of tritium-contaminated radioactive waste from Fukushima Daiichi into the Pacific Ocean. The country has faced intense international pressure to cancel the dumping. Japan's chief cabinet secretary, Hirokazu Matsuno, acknowledged, quote, the need to gain public support for the plan. Or as one activist put it, it's a typical Japanese government tactic to go one step backwards in order to jump two steps forward at a later time. According to Cindy Fokers, a radiation and health hazard specialist at Beyond Nuclear, TEPCO's data shows that even twice through filtration leaves the water 13.7 times more concentrated with hazardous radioactive tritium than Japan's allowable standard for ocean dumping. What kind of international pushback has there been to Japan's plans? Taiwan commissioned a study that revealed that the treated radioactive water is expected to arrive in Taiwan's waters in 1.5 years after its planned discharge. An editorial in the China Daily stated, the decision to dump the contaminated water into the ocean is not just a domestic issue of Japan. When there is potential danger that the radioactive water may cause lasting damage to the marine ecology and marine resources all over the world. This is a question for the international community as a whole to answer, the islands of the Pacific Ocean in particular, not just the Japanese government. The National Association of Marine Laboratories issued a position paper which states that it opposes Japan's plans to release this water based on the fact that there is a lack of adequate and accurate scientific data supporting Japan's assertion of safety. Furthermore, there is an abundance of data demonstrating serious concerns about releasing radioactively contaminated water. Jamie Quinton, head of the School of Natural Sciences at Massey University, said that the original unprocessed wastewater contained isotopes that were being used in nuclear medicine radiotherapy, and that means they have sufficient energy to cause cell death and mutation. In other words, according to Quinton, they are capable of producing cancers. While Quinton and others said that there is no scientific information on the effects of tritium on the marine environment, we will have some clarification on tritium in next week's show when we interview marine biologist Tim Deere Jones for some tritium talk. In Ukraine, at the 6-reactor Zaporizhzhia site, off-site power was completely lost on Thursday, March 9, for 11 hours, forcing it to rely on emergency diesel generators for reactor cooling and other essential nuclear safety and security functions. This marks the 6th time since the start of Russia's war on Ukraine that Zaporizhzhia has been cut off from external power lines. International Atomic Energy Agency Director Rafael Grossi said that the current situation was untenable, and quote, each time we are rolling the dice, and if we allow this to continue time after time, then one day our luck will run out. To which we add, and luck is a terrible safety plan when it comes to a nuclear reactor, let alone one in a war zone. In France, a large crack has been discovered in a nuclear reactor, EDF's Penly 1. What's new is the depth of the crack, 85% of the thickness of the metal. The crack was found in a part of the reactor which EDF had previously not considered prone to damage. The damage was only found following 5 months of intensive repair works at the site. We'll have the first of this week's interviews in just a moment, but first, wouldn't it be nice if wishing for a nuclear world would make it happen? But it won't. The entire nuclear fuel chain, from uranium mining to refining uranium ore to manufacturing nuclear weapons and reactor fuel to the forever radioactive legacy of the so-called spent fuel rods, as well as the threat of using nuclear bombs, all of it is out there, poisoning the land, the air, the water, and, unfortunately, us. And all of it is supported by a financially well-funded nuclear industry PR propaganda push that spends millions of dollars to embed their message in the news cycle, the public's brains, and, of course, those all-important legislators. That is why we need Nuclear Hot Seat. Now in its 12th year, Nuclear Hot Seat is the only podcast where you can reliably get a weekly one-hour hit of honest nuclear information, including interviews with genuine experts and frontline activists, as well as international news, numbnuts of the week, and the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story. We bring you the stories and insights that the nukesters and their political minions would rather you not know. So if you have come to value Nuclear Hot Seat and want to support the show's work, and I would hope that you would, the time to send us a donation would be right now. Any and every amount helps. How about $5, the same as an overpriced cup of coffee here in the U.S. Maybe set up $5 a month as a sustaining donation. Or, in either event, you can do more. It's easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, follow the prompts, do it now, and know that however much you can help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. Reference man is the term used for the standard first developed by the government and the nuclear industry in 1949 to establish maximum permissible amounts of radioactive materials in the human body. Not what's healthy, just what they will allow. But because humans are so diverse in age, gender, weight, height, lifestyles, geographic locations, and other factors, no reference man definition can possibly reflect anything other than a few individuals from the total population. But there is a better standard that can be developed to protect the health of us all, and that's what this week's interview is all about. Mary Olson founded the Gender and Radiation Impact Project in 2017. With a background in biology and biochemistry, she previously served from 1991 to 2019 as staff biologist and senior radioactive waste policy analyst at Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Her work on radiation education led her to question whether biological sex is a factor in radiation harm. She has presented her findings at the Vienna Conference on Humanitarian Impacts of Nuclear Weapons, the UN Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review of 2015, the International Committee of the Red Cross Asia Regional Meeting in St. Petersburg, Russia, and twice at the EU Gender Summit. We originally spoke on February 18, 2020.
Mary Olson, thanks so much for joining us here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks for inviting me, Libby.
Mary, I believe one of the reasons why people are not more alarmed about their exposure to nuclear radioactivity is that they simply don't understand it. Briefly, what is it, where does it come from, and what does it do to our bodies and our health?
I'm talking about ionizing radiation here with you today. So we're not today talking about cell phones or smart meters or that kind of thing, which is not the same as gamma rays, alpha particles, beta particles, neutrons. It all sounds very complicated, but it's not. These are charged particles and energetic waves that can disrupt both the structures of cells and much more easily the chemistry of cells, both of which can lead to disease.
What are the diseases we're talking about?
The one that our government looks at exclusively is cancer. And cancer is very much of a given from radiation exposure. We know there is no dose of radiation small enough to be safe from cancer. Every single exposure has some risk. The more exposure, the more risk. But there's non-cancer effects like infertility, loss of pregnancy, miscarriage, and spontaneous abortion. there's wearing down our immune systems. There's something called Chernobyl AIDS, which was from too many small exposures, wearing down immune systems. Heart impacts. There's a long list of non-cancer impacts that our government doesn't even look at. So primarily we talk about cancer because it's the one that is the most studied.
Much of our understanding of whether exposure to nuclear radiation, ionizing radiation, is dangerous or not comes in relationship to something called reference man. What is this? How did he come about? And what is his importance in our discussion of health impacts from nuclear radioactivity?
There's two pieces here, reference and man. Let's start with the man part. Back at the beginning of the atomic era in the discovery of radioactivity and then the immediate move to militarize it in the Manhattan Project, the people who were exposed to this new type of radioactivity coming from fission, splitting atoms, were primarily males, primarily military males, primarily young guys who could be characterized as GIs, general issues, right? So they made an envelope, a height, a weight, a lifestyle that corresponded to those guys. And that was kind of appropriate at the time. So the second part is the reference. So they have this one formula for who got any given radiation exposure. The problem is that our federal government and our states following behind it, and most of the world based on our system, never stopped to think about generalizing those radiation standards to the general public, where not everybody is 5'8" tall and weighs 145 pounds and has a young male lifestyle. The standards based on reference man are used for people of all ages, from infants to elders, male and female. And what we're going to be talking about, the fact is that not only is it inappropriate to use this standard based on a young man for a baby, it's also inappropriate to use it for a female of any age.
You said that it was a question that came from someone who heard you speak that started you off on the investigation of how radiation might have a different impact on women and children. Who was that woman? Where did this story come from?
Well, Libby, I was speaking in South Carolina about radioactive waste in a public setting. And afterwards, I always like to have time for questions and answers and discussion. And a woman asked me, was radiation more harmful to her body compared to a man's body? I had never heard this question. I knew most of the independent researchers on radiation of the 20th century because of my job at Nuclear Information and Resource Service. I just retired recently, but during those years, there was never any discussion of biological sex as a factor in radiation harm. So this woman's question really took me by surprise. I gave her a pregnancy answer, which was perfectly good, but she came back with, no, I'm not talking about pregnancy, I'm talking about my own body. And I couldn't answer it. And then about a year and a half later, reactors started exploding in Japan at Fukushima Daiichi. And I was mandated to reach out to Japan and be in touch with people who are being affected by that radiation. And all of a sudden, her question came back to me. And I realized that I had a moral obligation, since I didn't even know that the question existed, to try and find her an answer. And that event really turned the rest of the work I've done ever since.
How did you start doing your research on this? Where did you look? What were the sources? And what did you discover?
I did the thing we all do first. I Googled, and I didn't find anything. And I Googled pretty extensively, and I didn't find anything. So I had a mentor who I had been working with, Dr. Rosalie Bertel, for some years. Unfortunately, Rosalie was at the end of her life, had terminal cancer. And so she was the one who told me that 60 years of data from tracking the A-bomb survivors was now publicly available in a report that the National Academy of Sciences had put out in 2006. This is now 2011, so it's 4 years later. And indeed, the authors of that report acknowledge that radiation is more harmful to females, but that's all they say. They don't disclose where the numbers are or what the relative harm in the numbers is or anything. So I had to sit down with the rough numbers of so many cancers per 100,000. Happily, they were disaggregated by male and female, so I could look at the numbers for females versus males. And horrifically, Hiroshima and Nagasaki is where those A-bombs fell on whole cities full of people. So there were people of all ages who were all irradiated at the same time. They were all of them irradiated on the same day, which was August 6th, 1945. And 3 days later in Nagasaki, again, a whole city full of people, all ages, both genders, were irradiated at the same time. Those who survived, most did not survive. But this report had tracking data on the cancer incidents and cancer deaths amongst the people who were there in those two cities on those days and the age they were at the time that they were exposed. So it's one of the only places where we can look at a group of people large enough to do the kind of epidemiology where you can start generalizing from those numbers to people in general. And findings were very startling.
What did you discover and what was your response as you were coming up with this information?
The first discovery I made had to do with an exposure of adult men and women. And this was because the woman who asked me the question was an adult woman. So I was looking for an answer for her. And I discovered that when men and women get the same exposure over time, women will get 50% more cancers than the men. For every two men who died of cancer in the study group of A-bomb survivors, for every two men who died, three women died of cancer. To me, that was highly significant. And I wrote an initial paper called Atomic Radiation is More Harmful to Women. And it focused specifically on the adult. Soon thereafter, I went back and looked at all males and all females in the age groups that are to 5 years and then 6 to 10 years and on up to 80 years old. And the results are even more striking in children. As a biological researcher, when you get a doubling of almost anything, you stop, look, and listen. And amongst the youngest children, birth to 5 years old, for every boy who somewhere in his lifetime, not childhood cancers, but somewhere in his lifetime got cancer, two girls got cancer. That's a doubling, and it was very startling. Then we go back to reference man, and we use the assumptions of the regulator to predict those cancers from the exposure in question. And little boys got five times more cancer than expected by reference man as the model, but little girls got 10 times more. And 10 times is stop the music, set off the siren, drop everything else you're doing and try and get everybody to pay attention to this, because 10 times more cancer occurring in our population than is currently accounted for by these experts in little girls being exposed who become women over their lifetimes, 10 times more cancer than expected is a lot.
This must have been very startling for you because, in essence, you were in new territory. You were discovering something out of the data that nobody had come up with before. How did this impact you? How did it strike you?
You know, Libby, I had missed a memo about a previous publication from Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, but working full-time in this field, I'm Googling, I'm talking to people, I even published my first paper, and I still didn't know about that other paper. So the answer is, it's like being surrounded by a cone of silence, as they say in some media, and invisible, completely invisible. You know, they only use this little point called reference man on this whole big wad of information we now have. They're ignoring the rest. So it makes me feel a little bit muted, a little bit wrapped in cotton, if you will, but we're talking about it.
How does the use of reference man as the exclusive standard work against our understanding of the impact of radiation exposure?
Well, decision makers only see information that is completely based on reference man if it comes from the U.S. federal agencies that do licensing. Now, the Environmental Protection Agency has made a small little effort, but it's so inconsequential, I'm not going to waste our time on it. Our federal agencies look at everything in terms of a population, and they claim that reference man is representative of the human population. They don't understand that little boys and little girls are part of our life cycle. And you can't do something to a little girl that doesn't show up in the population if she survives long enough to become an adult, right? So they're completely ignoring the disproportionate impact of radiation on female bodies. And the real key is that there is greater impact no matter what the age of the female is in relation to a same-aged male. In every age group, the female is harmed more than the male.
Why would that be?
That is why Gender and Radiation Impact Project is what I'm doing these days, to foster a new generation of independent researchers asking those questions and building their careers around answering the question, why? Why would that be? We have no idea.
When we're talking about radiation exposure, I'm certain that there are people listening to this who are thinking, it doesn't impact me. I'm not near Fukushima. I'm not near Chernobyl. There's nothing around me. Give us a sense of just some of the ways that people might be exposed to the ionizing radiation from nuclear.
First off, we are including every medical and dental exposure in this discussion. We're also including every high-altitude airplane flight because atmosphere shields us. So the higher you go up in the air, the less shield you have from the natural radiation from space. And our media loves talking about space as the next frontier. And certainly a very few number of people are going to go there, but they're going to be challenged by the amount of radiation out there. We have radon in our homes. It's a radioactive gas. And as we build more efficient structures, homes that are tighter, the gas can build up. So unless we have a good radon test and we put in ventilation for that gas, we can get very high exposures. But the primary source of exposure is medical. And I just want to take a moment, Libby, and say that if you need imaging or treatment to save your life, you're less worried about the long-term consequences like reproduction and cancer. So I always share that I indeed had CAT scans to have my ankle replaced. But I had them over the age of 50 and well past childbearing. I think we need to be smart in our decisions about this because every single one of those exposures we now know can add up in a cumulative fashion and result in the same level of risk as a higher exposure. They aren't like pouring little teeny drinks, oh, it didn't affect us. Oh, yeah, it does.
What about radioactivity from, say, leftover fallout from the atmospheric bomb test or from nuclear reactors? Is that also an issue?
Absolutely. A primary example of this is sequestration of cesium that is very radioactive and very harmful to our bodies, taken up by trees. And in the northeastern United States, they discovered wood ash was pretty radioactive, and they figured out that the trees had stored the cesium, and people who heated with the wood then brought it back in and recycled it out into the atmosphere. The same thing happens with brush fires around Chernobyl, and I'm sure in the future in Japan, they've had more flooding problems than fire problems, but every time there is a fire of this vegetation that has absorbed the radioactivity, it gets remobilized into the smoke. And certainly the 2,000 detonations of nuclear weapons, all but two of them as tests on our planet, basically constitute a nuclear war without the war. And the fallout from those tests is cloaking the entire northern hemisphere and parts of the southern hemisphere with persistent radioactivity that were basically only 1 to 2 half-lives. And now we're getting into the complicated stuff, but it basically means, hell yeah, there's a lot more radioactivity still out there that's in our food and in our water. And these result in a different type of exposure that we know even less about. This is when you get radioactivity inside your body from drinking radioactive water or eating radioactive food. And, you know, seafood is wonderful food, but it concentrates up the food chain, as also milk from cows. The cow eats the radioactive grass, and the cow's body concentrates that cesium and strontium into its milk. These are fallout components from the nuclear weapons tests and from reactor accident. And that radioactive milk then is, we ingest it, or it gets even more concentrated if you make cheese and other dairy products out of it. And at this point, you know, a lot of that has moved through the system, but Chernobyl covered 40% of Europe in measurable levels of cesium. And certainly Fukushima Prefecture and areas outside of it in Japan have been heavily contaminated. With our global trade, you just don't know what you're getting.
And of course, speaking about the smoke that gets released, when we had the Woolsey fire here in Southern California 2 years ago, it was 2018, it started at the Santa Susana Field Lab, which is a Superfund site that had a nuclear meltdown and many radiation pits for disposal of radioactive materials on the site. And those were aerosolized as well. There are still tests coming back, but it's showing that it's not distant places that will put us at risk from radioactivity and the exposure to it, but it can be in our own backyards, whether we are aware of it or not.
Indeed. Nuclear power reactors are in over 30 states in the United States, and there's over 90 of them still operating, even though they're shutting down more rapidly than they will ever be built again. But they emit radioactivity on an ongoing basis that is, they say, okay for reference man, but there's no evaluation of the emissions from either nuclear power reactors or nuclear weapons production factories or any of the research labs like the one that you just cited that had that terrible fire and absolutely resulted in radioactive release. There was no way it did not. But these other sites have radioactive releases in an ongoing basis that are not evaluated for babies. They're only evaluated for reference man.
Now, you were asked to present this information to the United Nations in 2015. Who was that made to, and what was the impact of the presentation?
We held a side session during the review of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and the we included the nations of Ireland, Austria, Sweden, and several smaller island nations. And there were over 300 people who attended. And the rest of our presentations, I was one of a panel of four speakers. Our presentations were pointing out that humanitarian law has as much relevance to the impact of making, possessing, and potentially using nuclear weapons, humanitarian law is relevant as much or more than military law. It was the humanitarian law that was used to pass the prohibition on landmines that has made such a huge difference in the world. And it was because of the impact on non-combatants, the impact on women and children, and the impact through time that the General Assembly passed that landmine treaty instead of the Security Council. And so there's a huge difference between the laws for health and a sustainable future versus the laws of war. And so we were making the case on nuclear weapons that the laws of sustainability and health should apply to nuclear weapons. And the outcome of that in 2015, 2 years later, was the promulgation of the new treaty, the Convention on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. And it was really, really exciting to be part of that.
That treaty passed the United Nations.
Yes, there was an overwhelming vote in favor of the treaty language. Now, the process of a treaty is standard, which is once it's been passed in terms of what it says, then each nation has the option to sign it or not. And once it signs it, it has to ratify it, which in the United States means that the U.S. Senate has to also agree, not just the ambassador to the U.N., who would act on behalf of the president and the executive branch. So right now, the status is 81 nations have signed this new treaty prohibiting nuclear weapons, and 35 have ratified. When it hits 50 nations have ratified, it will go into force. And then nuclear weapons will be in the same category as chemical and biological weapons are today. They will be effectively illegal to own, to build, and to sell, and to use. Nobody goes marching into somebody else's nation to demilitarize part of their arsenal. So it's a voluntary process, but it will totally change the tilt of the table. And again, I'm just super thrilled to have contributed to that. There's even a little paragraph in the preamble that mentions this work.
It's a profound impact that you've had with this research and with what you've been able to share. You also have an observation about a key change you would like to see come about in terms of how we refer to exposure to nuclear radiation.
My recommended first step for addressing the disproportionate impact of radiation on girls and women is for our regulators to create and adopt a reference little girl. And just like reference man is currently used to appraise every single radiation dose and the hazards that are associated with it, everybody would be assumed to be a reference little girl. Now, this is just a first step, but it would really ensure protection for females of every age and female bodies of all types and begin to address our life cycle, protecting our life cycle instead of a quote-unquote population.
We're speaking for a special International Women's Day slate of programs for KPFA in San Francisco. And that area has its own unique problems with radioactivity, just two of which are the former Naval Yard at Hunter's Point, which is a Superfund site and a known site of radioactive materials, and also the existence of Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory up the coast, which is part of the nation's nuclear weapons complex. If people wish to become involved in nuclear issues in this area, where can they go and who can they connect with to learn more and find some actions they can get involved in?
Tri-Valley Cares is in the Bay Area and has focused on Lawrence Livermore and its role in the entire nuclear weapons complex. They work at the local level, but definitely plug in at the national scope. And Western States Legal Foundation and Physicians for Social Responsibility, both in the San Francisco Bay Area, are wonderful conduits to the global work and the international campaigns. And I really encourage people to consider being involved with either or both. And one other is called Mothers for Peace, down where the only operating nuclear reactor in California today is located, in San Luis Obispo. And the Mothers for Peace there have been watchdogs on that operation for many years.
We will provide links for all of these for KPFA, and we will also have them on the website nuclearhotseat.com under this episode. Any final thoughts, Mary?
Thank you. Yeah, reference little girl is really just a first step because our entire life cycle includes the reproductive phases. And so I think we need to take action before we have all the answers. But when we have all the answers, I can't help but think it will be even more protective than the idea of reference little girl. So no one should see her as radical, simply as protective.
Mary Olson, you've done astonishing work that is of global importance on this nuclear issue. And on behalf of women, children, those who love them, and Nuclear Hot Seat, I want to thank you for being my guest.
Thank you so much. It was great to be with you.
Mary Olson of the Gender and Radiation Impact Project. You can contact her through genderandradiation.org, which is where you will find extensive material and footnotes on all the issues we discussed. We'll have additional links on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 612. And while you're there, look for the yellow opt-in box. And if you haven't already, sign up to get one email a week with a link to that week's Nuclear Hot Seat episode and a brief summary of the material in the show. That's at Nuclear Hot Seat, number 612.
Activists, shout out.
Amid the hundreds of interviews I have done for Nuclear Hot Seat over the past 12 years, sometimes a person and a story stand out and stick with me. That's been the case for Mary Osco. She was one of the fierce fighters for cleanup of the North St. Louis Coldwater Creek area because she lived there, on the creek, played in it as a kid, ate homegrown vegetables from her yard that bordered the creek, knew nothing of the radioactive contamination, and came down with stage 4 lung cancer despite never having smoked. We spoke in 2016 at the Adams Next Door Symposium in North St. Louis, which featured, among many others, Dr. Helen Caldicott and Bob Alvarez. Mary knew that the cancer was a death sentence, and it is with that knowledge that she granted me this interview. We spoke on February 20th, 2016.
My name is Mary Osco. Back in 1986, my husband and I bought a house, the last house, the end of a dead-end street next to a six-acre park. What an idyllic little place to raise our then two-year-old daughter. So we moved in. I was a stay-at-home mom. My husband was doing a lot of painting and cleaning and rehab on the house to get it ready for us to live there. So I started taking my daughter right next outside of our door to Saintson Park. And I started walking in the park. And then after we got settled in and everything was quieter, my husband would keep her at night. And I had my alone time down in the park walking lap after lap. I started meeting neighbors. I started getting to know people. I walked 7 days a week. In June, it'll be 30 years that I've lived there. I started having some issues in maybe 2012, 2013 that I noticed. Other people said they noticed things that I complained about earlier than that, a couple years before that. But I just started having a lot of pain in my back. I started going to my primary care physician. And because I said I was a never smoker, we just went forward with testing for pulled muscles. Is it cardiac issues? Do we have some sort of skeletal thing going on? So we kept getting treated with pain pills after pain pills, muscle relaxers. And 2 days before I was to finish and become a nurse, I couldn't take the pain anymore, and my husband ran me for the second time in 2 days to the ER. They did a CT scan of my thoracic region, which is your lung area, and they wheeled me back into the ER room, and one of the physicians came in. He said, "We need to admit you up to the floor. You have lesions on your lung and your liver." Well, I knew what that meant. I had cancer. I slowly pivoted and looked at my husband, and I said, "I have cancer." And when they got me up to the room, you know, it was a progression of getting my IV started and our continued pain pills. I was on morphine. They did a PET scan, and I started being told the different stages of grief that I would go through, that it would be pneumonia that would kill me, not the cancer. And this was before I even had a definitive diagnosis. They went in through my back and did a biopsy on that next Monday morning, released me to go home. And 2 days later, I was sitting on the couch. My mother-in-law and brother-in-law were visiting with me, and I got the call that said, "Mary, you have adenocarcinoma. That means you're going to die." So it means I have a cancerous tumor of a glandular tissue. In my case, it was my lung. When we did our cancer unit when I was in nursing school, our instructor said, "Oh, I want to give you a big word, and I'll spell it for you. It's adenocarcinoma. If you ever have to be with your physician at the bedside of a patient and you give them this diagnosis, you are telling them they're going to die."
When did you put it together that where you were living had something to do with your medical condition?
We had heard through the years that there was dumping in the creek, but we thought it was from a car manufacturing plant, from an airplane manufacturing plant, and from the airport. There was fuels and things like that. I didn't know that it was radioactive waste. But about the time that I was diagnosed, it all started coming out more in the news. It was on Facebook a lot. Coldwater Creek, Just the Facts, was out there. And when I started reading about it and I knew that it was in the creek by our house, I looked at my husband and I said, "This is what's killing me. This is what I've been exposed to for 29 years. I've walked in that dust. I've walked in the dirt. I've inhaled it since 1986 when we took possession of the house. And the house that we lived in for 2 years previous to that was about a half a mile as the crow flies from Westlake Landfill, who got the atomic waste from Laddie Avenue storage site, and they illegally went over and dumped it into an unlined landfill area. I was about 2 miles from that. Where I grew up in St. Anne was where Coldwater Creek can end. And there were some little tributaries that come off of it. And one of them, we believe, I'm not for sure on this yet, ran into a park that was up behind my house. I played in that creek growing up. So, three strikes, you're out. If that is the case, that I played in that creek, which was coming off of Coldwater Creek, I'm not the one that you want to have help you find a house, because I'm going to find it next to radioactive waste. That means I've been exposed to it since I was one, you know, or old enough to go around and play in the park. I was diagnosed December 2013. I am considered stage 4, which is a terminal diagnosis. Lung cancer, pancreatic cancers are the most difficult to treat. Lung cancer kills more women a year than the next three cancers combined.
and yet we don't have a lot of funding. So that's a whole other story that we could talk about someday. So I've lived there. I've raised my children there. My children have multiple health issues, severe asthma as they were growing up, skin issues. My daughter now has some reproductive issues. My son has vomiting headache syndrome where he gets these migraines and he'll vomit out to where all the fluids are gone. We have to get him to the hospital. They'll run like 2,000 cc bag, you know, worth of fluids to get him rehydrated, and they'll give him medications. I put it together now and it's like we're all sick. My husband hasn't really shown so many signs yet, but we have. But then we started going through all of our neighbors that have died of cancers. On the street behind me, at one point, and most of these people are gone and been replaced by the next generation, we counted 27 people that had been diagnosed, and we're very short blocks. There are not a lot of houses on the two little dead-end streets where I live that dead-end into St. Vincent Park. So now we have the next generation of people that have moved in and bought these homes, not knowing, because the owners sold them in good faith. They didn't know. As of 3 years ago, if I would have sold my house, I had signed on the line, and I would not have known that anybody was moving next to radioactive waste from the Manhattan Project that was allowed to come out of rusty barrels that had been sitting up at the Laddie Avenue area that had big mounds of the salt byproduct that it rained on and it carried them down through the creek. And I'm really the first residential area that's there. So, you know, the park next to me, that 6-acre park, had a lot of hot spots in it. And they've even found these hot or active spots in the yards on the street behind me. You know, we've worried about what's in the dust inside of our homes. What have we been exposed to? So we're part of the legacy of this. And it makes me feel angry. It makes me feel like another victim of World War II. We built the bomb to do a job. It ended the war. We went in and we stopped Japan. We obliterated, you know, Nagasaki and Hiroshima. But then we brought that, you know, we had all that extraction and those materials that we made those bombs out of, and we just dumped it in a site that was not a heavily populated area. But when it started to get to be a developed area and it had a water source running right by it, nobody ever thought, we need to get that cleaned up. We need to get that contained. We need to get that shipped or put somewhere. Look at all these people. They not only did that, but once it got in out on the creek, they would take some of that, the creek bank as they were rerouting it, and they would use it to fill where they were building all these big subdivisions. We had a lot of growth from the city out toward North County that with that northward expansion. If there was a low spot in front of the house, they filled it in with creek dirt. If you needed to build up in front of the homes to put in a sidewalk, they used it with creek dirt. And when they were transporting this dirt around, they did it in uncovered trucks. So now, can they go along the roads and find it? They're not convincing those of us that are citizens, that are living in this area, that they're going to be able to clean this all up. How far down? Did they go far down enough? Did they it on a grid pattern? Did they get everything that's in between those spots? Did they get clean enough margins like you do with a tumor? How do we know that it hasn't metastasized like my cancer can, and it's kind of migrated or moved to another area? You know, they've said they've done it, and when they got clean margins, that's where they could stop testing and stop cleaning. It doesn't give me the reassurance that I need to go back and walk in the park where I need to get my strength back from having lung surgery, from having chemotherapy, from being on these chemo drugs, which I will be on for the rest of my life, whatever time they can have left. I'll never have a cure, as far as what I've been told, on my cancer. That makes me angry. That makes me angry that I will never stand bedside and I will never help another patient. Instead, I was the patient, and I had a nurse taking care of me. It makes me angry. I was one of the top students in my class, and now some of my classmates may become my hospice nurse or be the one that'll wipe my butt when I get to the point where I can't get out of bed. It makes me mad when my family sits around the table and my children are looking into my face, and they wonder what I'm thinking about, or maybe they don't, but I'm thinking about, what have I exposed you to? My son, do you have my genes? Did you get that genetic material that's mutated? I was pregnant 23 years ago. I've been there 30 years. Do the math. I was exposed to this during a pregnancy. And they're saying, well, who's most at risk are pregnant women and babies. I was a pregnant woman. I'm angry. I'm angry that so are my children going to be the next generation that'll start filling up the cancer wards at Mercy and Barnes and St. Luke's and DePaul? You can go now to one of my appointments, and you can barely find room to sit down. cancer is rampant. I believe that is because of the environmental waste and pollution that we have in our country, and I'm angry about that. I want this world to be cleaner than when I found the way I came in and found it, and it's not. And I feel like we have this small voice that's building in this city because we're mad. We are angry. We're going to go to Washington, D.C. We're going to talk to people that are on the local channels. We're going to talk to print journalists. We want our stories told. We're here, and we count. I was taken out of the job force as a nurse. I have a friend whose son was 28, died of lung cancer last year. He played ball on all those ball fields. He was married 1 year. He was taken out of his job and his profession and having a family. I have two or three other friends that were teachers. They're no longer in the classroom. We're losing a large population of people with gifts and talents to give to society because we're all at home on disability, trying to get out of bed enough to get to the bathroom, get a shower once a week, and get down to our oncology appointments. So they can stick us with another needle, try to pry some more tissue out of us, and see if they can keep us alive just a little bit longer. And you know, sometimes you wonder if it's worth it because it's painful, it's debilitating, it's fatiguing, it's depressing.
Mary Osco, recorded on February 20th, 2016. Ironically, she passed away exactly 7 years later on February 20th of 2023. Mary Osco was 63 years old. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, March 14, 2023. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's easy. Sign up on your favorite podcast channel or take it the easy way. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down for the yellow box, put in your first name and email address, and every week you will get one email with a link and a short description of the show's content. In this way, you will never miss a single episode. Now, if you've got a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Anything you can do, we appreciate your support. This is Libby Halevi, producer and host of Nuclear Hot Seat, and I'm going to give our final thought today to the late Mary Osco.
This is not just a North County, St. Louis County, near St. Louis airport in the state of Missouri problem. There is not a place you can go in the 50 states that's safe. There is not a place you can go on any continent that's safe. Look at Chernobyl and how many countries that affected. If you look at how that cloud went up and how it dispersed itself over Europe, and how these test clouds from New Mexico went up and dispersed themselves over states in the United States, we're safe. So no matter who is hearing my voice in whatever country, if you think you're safe, if you're in a little Polynesian island somewhere, you're not. It can be in the air, and it can be, and I always sign my emails now, it's in the soil. We have got to start letting our federal governments and our legislators know we do not want to live in this polluted, dirty environment anymore. We want it cleaned up. We want it contained. And nuclear energy, it shouldn't even be a consideration because there's a cost. We've got to look at something else. Where do you go with the storage of these products after they produce it? Once we mine it and get it out of those mines, you can't put it back the same way you got it. We're in a heap of trouble.
The late Mary Osco. So there you have it. If that's not your nuclear wake-up call, I don't know what is. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.